And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, it's another exciting day. It's October 2nd, 275th day of the year. Leap year is 276th. 90 days remain until the end of the year. On this date in history, in 829, Theophilus succeeds his father, Michael II, as Byzantine emperor. 939, Battle of Andernach. Otto I, Holy Roman Emperor, crushes a rebellion against his rule by a coalition of Eberhard of Franconia and of the Frankish dukes. The Franks were the French, by the way. 1187, siege of Jerusalem. Saladin captures Jerusalem after 88 years of crusader rule. There is still a hereditary title, King of Jerusalem. And it is in one of the French lines of nobility. 1263, the Battle of Large is fought between the Norwegians and the Scots. 1470, Earl of Warwick's rebellion against King Edward IV of England forces the king to flee to the Netherlands. Henry VI comes to the throne. 1528, William Tyndale publishes The Obedience of a Christian Man, which advocates the divine right of kings. The theory behind the divine right is their royal lines were somehow blessed by God. The Japanese believed that until the end of World War II, when the emperor was forced to admit that he was just a mortal man. 1535, Jacques Cartier discovers the present site of Montreal. 1552, Russo-Kazan Wars. Russian troops enter Kazan. 1780, Jean André, a British army officer who conspired with Benedict Arnold for Arnold to hand over West Point to the British. On this date in 1780, Jean André was hung as a spy by the Continental Army. 1789, Bill of Rights is sent to the various states for ratification. 1814, Chilean War of Independence. Royalist troops defeat Chilean forces of Bernardo O'Higgins and Jose Miguel Carrier. 1835, Texas Revolution. Mexican troops attempt to disarm the people of Gonzales, but encounter stiff resistance from a hastily assembled militia. You don't take the guns away from Texans. 1864, Confederates defeat a Union attack on Saltville, Virginia. A massacre of wounded Union prisoners ensues. That wasn't good. 1870, by plebiscite, the citizens of the Papal States accept annexation by the Kingdom of Italy. At one point in time, the Vatican was its own country. It had a number of states that they ruled over. But they decided they'd rather join the Kingdom of Italy. 1919, Woodrow Wilson suffers a massive stroke, leaving him incapacitated for several weeks. His wife ruled the country. 1928, the Prelature of the Holy Cross and the Work of God, commonly known as Opus Dei, is founded. And so began a series of conspiracy theories. 1937, Rafael Trujillo orders the execution of Haitians living in northwestern region of the Dominican Republic. 1941, Operation Typhoon of Wehrmacht attempts to capture Moscow before the onset of winter. Didn't work out. Had they done it, the war would have had a different outcome, I think. 1942, ocean liner RMS Queen Mary accidentally rams and sinks HMS Caracoa, killing 337 crewmen on aboard the Caracoa. 1944, World War II, German troops end the Warsaw Uprising. 1958, Guinea declares its independence from France. 1867, Thurgood Marshall is sworn in as the first African-American justice of the Supreme Court. 1968, Mexican President Gustavo Diaz Ordaz orders soldiers to suppress a demonstration of unarmed students 10 days before the start of the 1968 Summer Olympics. In 1970, an aircraft carrying the Wichita State University football team, administrators, and supporters crashes in Colorado. 31 people die. 1971, South Vietnamese President Nguyen Van Thieu is reelected in a one-man election. And even then, it was a close thing. In 1980, Michael Myers becomes the first member of either chamber of Congress to be expelled since the Civil War. 1990, Diamond Airlines Flight 8301 is hijacked and lands in Guangzhou, where it crashes into two other airliners on the ground. 128 people die. 1992, military police stormed the Carandiru Penitentiary in Sao Paulo, Brazil during a prison riot. The resulting massacre leaves 111 prisoners dead. 1996, Aero Peru Flight 603 crashes into the ocean near Peru, kills all 70 people on board. 1996, the Electronic Freedom of Information Act amendments are signed by President Bill Clinton. 2000, the revision dial algorithm is chosen by NIST as the AES standard. 2002, the Beltway sniper attacks begin, and they last over the next 3 weeks. 2004, the first park run, then known as the Bushy Park time trial, takes place in Bushy Park, London, in the UK. 2006, five Amish girls are murdered in a shooting at a school in Pennsylvania. 2007, President Roh Moo-hyun of South Korea goes to North Korea for an inter-Korean summit with North Korea Kim Jong-il, the current leader's father. 2016, Ethiopian protests break out during a festival in the Oromo region. Dozens of people die. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Holidays and observances, Batik Day in Indonesia, Christian feast days, Memorial of the Holy Guardian Angels, Leo Degar, Gandhi's birth-related observances, Gandhi Hayanti in India, International Day of Nonviolence, Independence Day, which celebrates independence of Ghana from France in 1958, and in Italy, it's National Grandparents Day. Now, let's see what else we might have. Let's see. 1944, I talked about the Warsaw Uprising. Polish resistance fighters finally throw in the towel. Over 250,000 people are killed in that uprising. 1957, the movie Bridge Over the River Kwai, directed by David Lean and starring William Holden and Alec Guinness, is released. Best Picture in 1958. Beatrix Potter's The Tale of Peter Rabbit is published by Frederick Warren and Company in London in 1902. And birth dates, Richard III, born in 1452. Paul von Hindenburg, born in 1847. Gandhi's birthday, born in 1869. Coco the Clown, born in 1900. Sting's birthday. And in a 1,100-kilometer race in Australia in 1971, homing pigeons averaged a record of 133 kilometers per hour. Famous death, Samuel Adams died in 1803 on this date. Marcel Duchamp died in 1968. Jamal Khashoggi died in 2018. And Rock Hudson died on this date in 1985. Okay. See what else we got. 1976, Hisham II is appointed caliph in Cordoba. 1492, King Henry VII of England invades France. 1518, English Cardinal Thomas Wolsey makes a European plan. 1540, Venice and Turkey sign peace treaty. 1552, the conquest of Kazan by Ivan the Terrible. 1572, the Spanish army occupies, plunders, and destroys Mechelen. 1608, Hans Lippershey applies for a patent for the first known telescope in the Netherlands. 1614, French King Louis XIII is declared an adult by a court of law at the age of 13. 1627, the last emperor of the Chinese Ming Dynasty, Chongzhen, comes to the throne after the death of his brother, Emperor Tianqi. 1656, the North American colony of Connecticut passes a law outlawing Quakers. 1700, Spanish King Carlos II appoints Philip von Anjou heir to the throne. 1799, the Duke of York and Russians capture Alkmaar in the Netherlands. 1835, I talked about the attempts by the Mexican military to disarm the citizens of Gonzales. That battle actually was the first engagement in what became the Texas Revolution. 1836, Charles Darwin, after 5 years at sea on board the HMS Beagle, returns to England. 1861, former U.S. Vice President John C. Breckinridge flees Kentucky. 1866, Jay Osterhout patents a tin can with a key opener, kind of like they used to have on the Vienna sausage. 1870, Italy annexes Rome and the Papal States. Rome becomes the Italian capital. 1871, on this date, Brigham Young, the Mormon leader, is arrested for bigamy. He's also the founder of Salt Lake City and president of the Church of Latter-day Saints. 1872, Morgan State University is founded. 1872, Phineas Fogg sets out on his journey, as written about by Jules Verne in Around the World in 80 Days. Yeah, let's see. 1889, in Colorado, Nicholas Creed strikes it rich in silver during the last great silver boom of the American Old West. In 1895, and this is an important date, folks, there may be a written test, first cartoon comic strip is printed in a newspaper. 1901, the first Royal Navy submarine is launched at Barra-in-Furness. 1904, German General Lothar von Trotha issues an order to exterminate the Hero people of Numidia. That's the first genocide in the 20th century. 65,000 Herero and 100,000 of the Nama tribe are killed. 1906, Canadian World Heavyweight Boxing Champion Tommy Burns knocks out American challenger fireman Jim Flynn in 15 rounds to retain his title in Los Angeles, California. 1910, the first two aircraft collision in Milan, Italy. That reminds me of the story of, I forget which state it was, but there were two cars registered in the state. And the two had a wreck. They hit each other. 1916, the San Diego Zoo is founded. 1925, Josephine Baker first performs in Paris in La Vue Negre at the Théâtre des Champs-Élysées. That's 1935. Mussolini's Italian army attacks Abyssinia, also known as Ethiopia. They overthrew the emperor. Ethiopia had an emperor until that time. Then they had to bring in the Germans to save the Italian army. In 1940, the British liner Empress, loaded with refugees heading for Canada, sinks. 1941, the Germans launched their attack on Moscow. 1943, Japanese troops leave Kolombangara in the Solomon Islands. 1946, the first network soap opera called Follower Hills began broadcasting on Dumont Television Network. 1950, the first strip of Charlie Brown, which was called Little Folks, later Peanuts, by Charles Schulz, was published in 7 nationwide newspapers. Is there anything else of interest? The Twilight Zone premiered in 1959. It was on CBS. The TV show Ben Casey premiered on NBC in 1961. I periodically watched it when it was nothing else of interest. 1963, West German Chancellor Konrad Adenauer condemns Western grain shipments to Russia. 1965, Pope Paul VI named M.R. Perret Bishop's Helper of New Orleans. 1974, future Baseball Hall of Fame right fielder Hank Aaron hits his final home run as a member of the Atlanta Braves. They beat the Cincinnati Reds 13-0. 1980, Muhammad Ali, who's 38, comes out of a 2-year retirement to challenge undefeated world heavyweight champion Larry Holmes at Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas. Ali beat him like a rug for 10 rounds before the corner was thrown in. Ali pounded unmercifully for 10 rounds before the corner throws in the towel. Well, I think that pretty well covers that. Now, we're going to turn from history of one sort to what amounts to history of another. We're going to be talking about conspiracies today. You know, you hear the phrase conspiracy theory, and it has a negative connotation. And to a lot of people, conspiracy theories are irrational, overimaginative ideas endorsed by people looking for attention, and there's really no evidence to support them. However, there have been many times when governments or individuals have participated in conspiracies. And it'd be naive to think that intelligence agencies, militaries, government officials, politicians, and the average individual on the street doesn't sometimes cooperate in covert, secretive ways. Look at the deep state that has been plaguing the country since Trump was elected. And what's his crime? He wasn't Hillary. Well, the first one we're going to start with actually had a major impact on society. It was the Gulf of Tonkin incident. Now, the little background, August 4th, 1964, Captain John J. Herrick, commander of the USS Maddox, a Navy vessel on an intelligence gathering mission in the Gulf of Tonkin, reported to the White House and Pentagon that North Vietnamese patrol boats had fired torpedoes at his ship. So the Maddox fired back. 2 days later, Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara testified to Congress he was certain the Maddox had been attacked. He swore the Maddox had been attacked. So on August 7th, Congress passed the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution. It allowed President Johnson to free rein to start and continue and carry out what became known as the Vietnam War. Now, Johnson immediately ordered airstrikes on North Vietnam, and this little shooting affair would eventually kill 58,000 American soldiers and 2 million Asians was underway. Now, since then, it's been shown and, in fact, proven that no North Vietnamese boats ever fired on the Maddox, and that McNamara had lied when he testified before Congress. According to the official publication of the Naval Institute, once classified documents and tapes released in the past several years combined with previously uncovered facts make it clear that high government officials of the United States government distorted facts and deceived the American public about events that led to full U.S. involvement in the Vietnam War. Now, in the weeks prior to the Gulf of Tonkin incident, South Vietnamese ships had been attacking posts in North Vietnam in conjunction with CIA's Operation 34A. And according to a lot of inside sources, the Johnson administration wanted to have a full-scale war in Vietnam. And through Operation 34A, was trying to provoke North Vietnam into an attack that would give Johnson an excuse to go to war. But when McNamara was testifying to Congress on August 7th, and he was asked if these South Vietnamese attacks had anything to do with the U.S. military and the CIA, McNamara lied and said no. Now, within hours after reporting that the Maddox had been attacked, Captain Herrick was retracting his statements and reporting to the White House and Pentagon. In all likelihood, an overeager sonar man had been mistaken that the sonar sounds and images he thought were enemy torpedoes were actually just the beat of the Maddox's own propellers. Herrick went on to report there was a good probability there had not been an attack on the Maddox and suggested a complete reevaluation of the matter be undertaken before any action was taken. Well, McNamara saw these new and updated reports and talked with Johnson about them on the afternoon of August 4th. And even though he now knew that the initial reports were in error, on the evening of August 4th, Johnson went on national television and announced to the American public North Vietnam had engaged in unprovoked aggression. And as a result, the U.S. military was retaliating. A few days after the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, Johnson made the remark, "Those damn stupid sailors were just shooting at flying fish." Now, that came from The Truth About Tonkin in the Naval History magazine, which was published 2008. Recently, new documents related to the Gulf of Tonkin incident have been declassified, and according to Robert Hancock, a historian for the National Security Agency, these documents show that the NSA, National Security Agency, deliberately distorted intelligence and altered documents to make it appear that an attack had occurred on August 4th. When President Johnson misrepresented to the American public and said he knew the North Vietnam had attacked a U.S. ship, and when Defense Secretary Robert McNamara lied to Congress and said he was sure the Maddox had been attacked and the CIA had nothing to do with South Vietnamese aggression, and when NSA officials falsified information to make it appear there had been an attack on the Maddox, you can't call it anything else but a government conspiracy. And I wasn't the only one. 1962, the most powerful and highest-ranking military officials of the U.S. government, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, felt strongly that communist leader Fidel Castro had to be removed from power. So they came up with a plan to justify an American invasion of Cuba. This plan, which they called Operation Northwoods, was presented to Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara on March 13, 1962, and was signed by the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Lyman Limnitzer. Now, Operation Northwoods was a proposal for a false flag operation, a plan in which a military organizes an attack against its own country and then frames and blames the attack on another country. And this is done to initiate hostilities and declare war on that other country. Now, proposal was originally labeled top secret, but was made public on November 18, 1997 by the John F. Kennedy Assassination Records Review Board. The complete Operation Northwoods paper was published online by the National Security Archive on April 30, 2001, and anybody can now read this once secret document. Now, the actions that Limnitzer and the other chiefs wanted to take under Operation Northwoods are, many people say, shocking. According to the plan, CIA military personnel and hired provocateurs would commit various violent acts, and these acts would be blamed on Castro to create the necessary impression of Cuban rashness and irresponsibility and put the United States in the apparent position of suffering defensible grievances. In other words, it made the Cubans look like they shot first. Now, one of the most ambitious plans of Operation Northwoods was to blow up a plane in mid-flight. The strategy was to fill a civilian airplane with CIA military personnel who were registered under fake IDs, and then have an exact duplicate plane, an empty military drone aircraft, take off at the same exact time. The plane of fake passengers would land at a military base, but the empty drone plane would fly over Cuba and clash in the ocean, supposedly a victim of Cuban missiles. Then there would be a casualty list published in U.S. papers, and there would be fake funerals for mock victims that would help create a wave of national indignation in America. It also said we could blow up a U.S. ship and blame Cuba. Whether the ship was to be empty or full of U.S. soldiers wasn't really clear. The document also said hijacking attempts against U.S. civil air and surface craft should be encouraged. Some of the recommendations of Operation Northwoods would have surely led to serious injuries and even deaths of both Cuban and American civilians. Also suggested in the plan was sinking a boatload of Cubans en route to Florida, and it was irrelevant to the planners whether this was to be a real simulated sinking. And they said we could foster attempts on lives of anti-Castro Cubans in the U.S., even to the extent of wounding in instances to be widely publicized. Also explode a few bombs in carefully chosen spots. Now, Limnitzer and the chiefs wanted many of these staged terrorist attacks to be directed at the Guantanamo Bay United States Naval Base in Cuba. Among the plans that they suggested was starting riots near the entrance to the base, shoot mortar shells from outside the base to inside the base, blow up ammunition inside the base, start fires, burn aircraft on the airbase, sabotage ships in the harbor, and use napalm to start large fires. Now, when Secretary of Defense McNamara was presented with Operation Northwoods, he either stopped and rejected the plan himself or gave it to President Kennedy, and Kennedy rejected it. But if Kennedy and McNamara had agreed with the plan, then the Joint Chiefs of Staff wanted to begin enacting Operation Northwoods right away, within a few months. Well, even though Operation Northwoods was never initiated, when the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and other high-ranking military officials of the United States planned to organize violent attacks on Americans or anti-Castro Cuban citizens, knowing these attacks would severely injure or kill those citizens, and when they planned to blame those attacks on Cuba or anybody else for that matter, and use it as an excuse to invade some other country, that's without a doubt a government conspiracy. Now, I wrote a book about that going into detail called The Northwood Conspiracy. You might find it interesting reading. Well, let's look at law enforcement conspiracies. Let's talk about the FBI and the Mafia. Now, in March of 1965, the FBI had the House of New England organized crime boss, Raymond Patriarca, wiretap and overheard two mobsters, Joseph Barboza and Vincent Flemmy, asking Patriarca for permission to kill another gangster by the name of Edward Deegan. 2 days later, Deegan's blood-soaked bodies found dead in a Boston alley. Within days, an official FBI report confirmed that Joseph Barboza and three of the mobsters were the murderers. Now, instead of those men going to prison for murder, though 3 years later, another man named Joseph Salvati was brought to trial for the murder of Edward Deegan. At that trial, Joseph Barboza testified and lied that Salvati was one of the murderers. And on the basis of Barboza's testimony, Joseph Salvati was convicted of murder and sentenced to life in prison. Now, at that same point in time, in the mid-60s, the FBI is being pressured more and more to do something to stop organized crime, even though J. Edgar Hoover insisted that the Mafia was a figment of somebody's imagination. So the Bureau began using members of the Mafia, criminals and murderers, to inform against fellow Mafia members. Joseph Barboza was one of those FBI-protected paid informants. So the FBI didn't want Barboza to go to prison for the murder of Deegan because they wanted him to continue infiltrating the Mafia and testifying against other Mafia officials. The Bureau apparently did want a conviction in a Deegan murder case, though, so they let Barboza lie under oath and let a man they knew to be innocent, Joseph Salvati, go to prison. Well, the Witness Protection Program, which has become so well known in movies and newspaper articles, was first created for the benefit of Joseph Barboza. And Barboza was the first Mafia informant to be protected under the program. After helping to convict a number of mobsters, Barboza was sent off to California to live a quiet life. Now, while under witness protection, Barboza committed at least one other murder, and maybe more. On trial for a murder in California, FBI officials showed up for Barboza's trial and testified on his behalf, which helped him get a much lighter sentence than he should have had. Joseph Salvati ended up serving 30 years in prison for a murder he didn't commit. And during that 30-year period, lawyers for Salvati requested documents from the FBI that would prove Salvati's innocence, but the Bureau refused to release them. Finally, in 1997, other evidence came forth suggesting Salvati's innocence, and the governor of Massachusetts, William Weld, at the time, granted his release. Well, a few years later, the FBI was ordered to release all its reports on the case. Hundreds of documents surfaced showed that the FBI knew Barboza was a murderer, and he had murdered Edward Deegan, and that Joseph Salvati had nothing to do with it. So in a court of law, Salvati was exonerated and eventually awarded millions of dollars in a civil lawsuit against the government. Three other defendants were also exonerated. At the 1968 trial, Joseph Barboza testified that three other men who were not guilty of anything, had participated in Deegan's murder. And these three innocent men were, along with Salvati, also sent to prison. Maybe the most shocking thing that surfaced from those documents was the fact that FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover himself knew Salvati was innocent and that Barboza had been the man that killed Deegan. And Hoover was working closely, almost daily, with the agents handling Joseph Barboza. And it was most likely Hoover himself who was directing the operation. The congressional committee that investigated the case was the House Committee on Government Reform, and Congressman Dan Burton was the chairman. When asked by CBS 60 Minutes journalist Mike Wallace, did J. Edgar Hoover know all this? Burton replied, oh yes, it's one of the greatest failures in the history of American justice. J. Edgar Hoover knew Salvati was innocent. He knew it, and his name shouldn't be emblazoned on the FBI headquarters. We should change the name of that building immediately. Now, Burton claimed that there was evidence that there were more cases when the FBI did the same sorts of things it did in the Salvati case. When Burton and his committee requested the files on these cases, the Attorney General and the White House refused to release them. When the FBI director, J. Edgar Hoover, and top FBI officials let a known murderer lie and perjure himself in a courtroom, and when they let four men they know to be innocent suffer in the hell of a prison cell for 30 years, and when they deliberately covered that up for decades, you can't call that anything but a conspiracy. Well, 1939, Albert Einstein and two other European physicists sent a letter to President Roosevelt informing Roosevelt the German government was working on developing the science that could lead to the creation of a nuclear bomb. Well, FDR immediately formed a committee to look into the idea of the U.S. government making its own atomic bomb. 1942, the Manhattan Project, the United States program to build a nuclear bomb headed by General Leslie Groves of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers was formed. Now, that program existed from 1942 to 1946, spent $2 billion, had plants and factories in 30 cities, and employed 130,000 workers. But interestingly enough, virtually nobody knew about it. The Manhattan Project's been called the greatest secret ever kept. The U.S. government wanted to keep the project a secret so Germany or one of America's other enemies wouldn't find out about it and more quickly build their own larger, better bomb. Early 1940s, when American scientists began working on splitting the atom and nuclear fission, the U.S. government officials asked the scientists to not publish any reports on the work in scientific journals. So the work was kept quiet. 1943, when newspapers began reporting on the large Manhattan Project construction going on in a few states, the newly formed United States Government Office of Censorship asked newspapers and broadcasters to avoid discussing atom smashing, atomic energy, atomic fission, and the use for military purposes of radium or other radioactive material. And, amazingly enough, the press kept their mouth shut. Now, the government didn't talk about the Manhattan Project, and the press didn't report about it, and the public knew nothing about it. Not even the 130,000 Manhattan Project laborers knew they were building an atomic bomb. 1945, a Life magazine article wrote that before Japan was attacked with atomic bombs, probably no more than a few dozen men in the entire country knew the meaning of the Manhattan Project. Perhaps only 1,000 others were even aware the work on atoms was involved. The workers were told they were doing an important job for the government, but they weren't told what the job was and didn't understand the full import of the mysterious daily tasks they were doing. They were warned that disclosing the project's secrets was punishable by 10 years in prison and a hefty financial fine. Whole towns and cities were built where thousands of Manhattan Project workers lived and worked, but they didn't know they were helping to build nuclear bombs. Now, the Manhattan Project finally became known to the public on August 6, 1945, when President Truman announced America had dropped a nuclear bomb on Hiroshima, Japan. Truman himself hadn't been informed of the project till late April 1945. When the government kept the purpose of the Manhattan Project a secret from the press and from the public, from America's enemies, and then from Harry Truman, and even from the 130,000 laborers who worked on the Manhattan Project, you can't call that anything but a government conspiracy. Now, in defense of this particular conspiracy, in 1943, there is a great deal of evidence the Germans actually dropped a small nuclear weapon, or atomic weapon, rather, on Russian forces and absolutely obliterated them. The problem was they couldn't get their weapon into full manufacture fast enough. At the time of Germany's surrender, they actually sent the components to build nuclear weapons to Japan. And that U-boat actually surrendered in mid-ocean. And supposedly, the components were used because we didn't have enough fissionable material to make but one of the bombs. The second one was done with the material that was captured from the German U-boat, at least according to one story I've heard. Let's talk about the church committee. In the early 1970s, after the Watergate affair and investigative reports by the New York Times, now keep in mind, the Times in the past has done some phenomenal work. The problem is, when you believe your own publicity, you think you're infallible. But in the early 70s, it became apparent the CIA and other U.S. intelligence agencies might be engaging in inappropriate and illegal activities. In 1975, the Church Committee, named after the committee's chairman, Senator Frank Church, was formed to investigate abuses by the CIA, the NSA, the FBI, and the IRS. Now, the Church Committee reports are said to constitute the most extensive investigations of intelligence activities ever made available to the public. And a lot of very disturbing facts came to light. According to the final report of the committee, U.S. intelligence agencies have been engaging in unlawful or improper conduct and intelligence excesses at home and abroad since the administration of Franklin Roosevelt. And I would add that probably before then. The report added that intelligence agencies have undermined the constitutional rights of citizens and checks and balances designed by the framers of the Constitution to ensure accountability have not been applied. One of the most well-known revelations of the committee was the CIA's so-called Family Jewels report that detailed the CIA's misdeed dating back to Dwight Eisenhower's presidency. The committee also reported on the NSA's Shamrock and Minaret programs. Under these programs, the NSA had been intercepting, opening, and reading the telegram and mail of thousands of private citizens. Church Committee also discovered and exposed the FBI's COINTEL program, the Bureau's program to covertly destroy and disrupt any groups or individuals that J. Edgar Hoover felt were bad for America. And who made the decision? Why, none other than J. Edgar Hoover himself. Some of the movements and groups the FBI tried to discredit and destroy were the Civil Rights Movement, the Anti-Vietnam War Movement, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and individuals such as Martin Luther King Jr. The most alarming thing the Church Committee found, though, was the CIA had an assassination program. Duh. It was revealed the CIA assassinated or had tried to assassinate Dinh Diem of Vietnam, Rafael Trujillo of Dominican Republic, General Rene Snyder of Chile, Fidel Castro, and that was a comedy of errors, let me tell you, Patrice Lumumba of the Congo, and other political leaders throughout the world. The committee learned about the different ways the CIA had developed to kill and assassinate people. They could inflict cancer, which supposedly has been done to several people involved in some of the people I write about in the assassination files. They inflict heart attacks to make murders look like suicides. They have car accidents, boating accidents, and shootings. At one point, CIA Director William Colby presented to the committee a special heart attack gun the CIA had created. It was able to shoot a small poison-laden dart into its victim. The dart was so small as to be undetectable, and the victim's death from the poison would appear to be a heart attack. What they did, this doesn't say is that those little darts were actually created out of ice, so they would just melt away. In response to the Church Committee report in 1976, President Gerald Ford signed Executive Order 11905 that forbade employees of the U.S. government from engaging in or conspiring to engage in political assassination. That same year, the Senate approved Senate Resolution 400, which established the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. Talk about a misnomer. A committee responsible for providing vigilant oversight over the intelligence agencies. Now, many former CIA employee whistleblowers and other people, though, claim the U.S. intelligence agencies are still acting in improper ways. In 2008, it was revealed that the CIA had hired Blackwater, a private company made up of ex-Navy SEALs, to track down and assassinate suspected terrorists. Later in the 2000s, when Congress formed a committee to investigate if CIA waterboarding and other methods of interrogation constituted torture, congressmen complained they couldn't get to the bottom of the matter because CIA officials and the CIA director were lying to the congressional committee. Oh my God, the CIA lies? I'm shocked. 45 years after the revelations of the Church Committee, it seemed U.S. intelligence agencies were still engaging in covert and improper conduct. When U.S. intelligence agencies and CIA plot to influence the affairs of foreign governments and foreign nations, when the CIA plots assassinations and does assassinate foreign leaders and political dissidents, and when the CIA develops new ways to kill and assassinate and interrogate and torture, and when they keep all that away from the Congress, press, and the public, there is nothing you can call it but a conspiracy. Now, here's this next one. I've heard a lot of back and forward and upside down. The question is, do Freedom of Information Act files prove FDR had foreknowledge of Pearl Harbor? Now, there have been a lot of people argue that FDR wanted us to get into the war so badly that when he found out the Japanese planned to attack Pearl Harbor, he let it take place. Well, on November 25th, 1941, Japan's Admiral Isoroku Yamamoto sent a radio message to the group of Japanese warships that would attack Pearl Harbor on December 7th. And newly released naval records prove that from November 17th to November 25th, the United States Navy intercepted 83 messages that Yamamoto sent to his carriers. Now, part of the November 25th message read, the task force keeping its movement strictly secret, maintaining close guard against submarines and aircraft, shall advance into Hawaiian waters and upon the very opening of hostilities shall attack the main force of the United States fleet in Hawaii and deal it a mortal blow. Now, since World War II, many people have suspected that Washington knew Pearl Harbor was the Pearl Harbor attack was going to take place. When Thomas Dewey was running for president against Roosevelt in 1944, he found out about America's inability to intercept Japan's radio messages and thought this knowledge would enable him to defeat FDR. In the fall of that year, Dewey planned a series of speeches charging FDR and foreknowledge of the attack. Ultimately, General George Marshall, chairman of the Joint Chiefs at the time, persuaded Dewey not to make those speeches. You see, Japan's naval leaders didn't know we had cracked their codes and those speeches would have sacrificed our code-breaking advantage. So, being a patriotic American, Dewey said nothing, and in November, FDR was elected president for the fourth time. But according to Robert Stennett, author of Day of Deceit, we have proof that FDR knew. Stennett's book is dedicated to Congressman John Moss, the author of America's Freedom of Information Act. According to Stennett, the answers to the mysteries of Pearl Harbor can be found in the extraordinary number of documents he was able to obtain through the Freedom of Information Act request. Cable after cable of decryption, scores of military messages that America was intercepting clearly showed Japanese ships were preparing for war and heading straight for Hawaii. Now, Stennett spent 16 years delving into the National Archives. He pored over more than 200,000 documents and conducted dozens of interviews. And at the end of all that, he came to a firmly held conclusion. Beyond a shadow of a doubt, FDR knew. Well, in 1940, Roosevelt made his famous campaign statement, "You boys are not going to be sent into any foreign wars." And he wasn't being duplicitous. FDR's military and State Department leaders were agreeing that a victorious Nazi Germany would threaten the national security of the United States. In White House meetings, the strong feeling was that America needed a call to action. But the public didn't want that. That's the reason that later on, in 1962, they came up with Northwoods to get the country behind the idea of going to war with Cuba. 80-90% of the American people want nothing to do with Europe's war. So according to Stennett, Roosevelt provoked Japan to attack us, let it happen at Pearl Harbor, and galvanized the country to war. Many who came into contact with Roosevelt during that time hinted that FDR wasn't being forthright about his intentions in Europe. In fact, after the attack on Sunday evening of December 7th, 1941, Roosevelt had a brief meeting in the White House with Evan R. Murrow, the famed journalist, and William Donovan, the founder of the Office of Strategic Services. Later on, Donovan told an assistant he believed FDR welcomed the attack and didn't seem surprised that it happened. Only thing Roosevelt seemed to care about, Donovan believed, was if the public would now support a declaration of war. According to Day of Deceit, in October 1940, FDR adopted a specific strategy to incite Japan to commit an overt act of war. Part of that strategy was to move America's Pacific Fleet out of California and anchored in Pearl Harbor. Admiral James Richardson, the commander of the Pacific Fleet, strongly opposed keeping the ships in harm's way in Hawaii, and he expressed this directly to Roosevelt. And as a result, the president relieved him of his command. Later on, Richardson quoted Roosevelt as saying, sooner or later, the Japanese would commit an overt act against the United States and the nation would be willing to enter the war. To those who believe that government conspiracies can't possibly happen, you need to read Day of Deceit, and it will give you a different view. Stinnett's book makes a convincing case that the highest officials of the government, to include the president, fooled and deceived millions of Americans about one of the most important days in the history of the country. According to Gore Vidal, Robert Stinnett's come up with most of the smoking guns. Day of Deceit shows that the famous surprise attack was no surprise to our war-minded rulers, and John Tolan, who the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of the Pearl Harbor book Infamy, says step by step, Stinnett goes through the prelude to war using new documents to reveal the terrible secrets that have been disclosed to the public. You know, the sad thing is, so many people looked up to Roosevelt, and he did a lot of good. There's no question about it. But at the same time, he caused a lot of harm. Now, from Roosevelt, let's go to Lyndon Johnson. Turns out that one of Lyndon Johnson's lawyers claimed that Johnson participated in the conspiracy to assassinate President Kennedy. Now, current Gallup polls show that many Americans believe that President Kennedy's assassination was a result of conspiracy and that Vice President Johnson participated. In fact, in November 2003, the History Channel, to commemorate the 40th anniversary of the assassination, finished its The Men Who Killed Kennedy series by doing a show that actually supported the theory Lyndon Johnson was behind the assassination. Now, the principal source of information for that particular segment was Barr McClellan, an attorney who from 1966 to 71 worked for the Austin, Texas law firm of Edward Clark. And Edward Clark was Lyndon Johnson's closest confidant. In fact, that firm handled all of Johnson's legal affairs. And according to a 1950s Reader's Digest article, Clark was also the secret boss of Texas. You may think that odd that one man could be that powerful, but I ran into the same thing in the state of Georgia, where the most powerful man was a judge named John H. Land, who firmly supported taking property from what he considered less entitled people and giving it to those who were smart enough to know what to do with the property. But getting back to Clark, from the late 30s to the late 60s, through his many and close relations with Texas judges and legislatures, and through his control of the secret roundtable that ran the state, Clark was, in fact, the de facto head of the Lone Star State. Barr McClellan claims that Edward Clark was also Lyndon Johnson's kingmaker and mastermind, and that Clark's power and influence were essential to forging Johnson's political career. And Barr McClellan also claims in the wake of Lyndon Johnson's rise to political stardom, there are a lot of suspicious deaths can be theoretically and evidentially linked to Edward Clark. And one of those first of those suspicious deaths was connected to the 1948 Texas Senate race. On the evening of the election, when the results were announced, it was clear Johnson lost his bid to be the Democratic nominee for Texas Senator. 3 days later, after Edward Clark had sent one of his lawyers to pay a visit to George Parr, a corrupt political boss in South Texas, and the precinct chair for the town of Alice, Texas, he called into the election central and announced that a mistake had been made in box 13 and that Lyndon Johnson had more votes than originally reported. The new tally gave Johnson a victory of 87 votes. And everybody in Texas knew the fix was in. I mean, paying precinct chairs to rig votes was, after all, a common practice in Texas state politics. And after Clark used an associate's relationship to a Supreme Court judge to get the Supreme Court to give the now contested election to Johnson, Lyndon Johnson became known as Lying Lyndon. I mean, Johnson was a joke to the officials and politicians in Texas who felt there was no way that Lying Lyndon would ever get to serve more than one term as senator. Later in 1952, a man named Sam Smithwick, one of Parr's sheriff deputies, announced that he could produce the missing ballots from Box 13 and prove what everybody around Texas knew, that Johnson had stolen the election. At that time, Smithwick was in prison for shooting one of Parr's political enemies, and he thought coming clean about the election would help him with his sentence. Shortly before Smithwick was to meet with Coke Stevenson, Johnson's defeated opponent, he was found dead in his prison cell. Prison coroner ruled it a suicide without doing an autopsy. 1948 election. After the 1948 election, Edward Clark had arranged for a friend, Pete Cofield, to serve on the State Board of Prisons, and Barr McClellan feels Clark could easily have arranged a murder through Cofield. Having convicts or guards eliminate problem prisoners was another Texas tradition. Newspapers reported that the death stunk to high heaven and reeked of corruption, and Texans openly suspected Lyndon Johnson was connected to Smithwick's death. A year prior to that, a man named Mack Wallace was arrested and convicted for killing a man named Doug Kinzer. On the night he was apprehended, when the arresting officer asked Wallace what he did for a living, he said, "I work for Senator Johnson." Wallace, in all likelihood, wasn't consciously attempting to hint he had done the murder for Johnson. He was rather simply stating a fact. He had been the student body president of the University of Texas in Austin. And okay, in the 1940s, he'd become acquainted with Clark and Johnson. In 1950, Johnson, for the purpose of making him political operative, had personally arranged for Wallace to take a job in the Department of Agriculture. Now, Doug Kinzer was one of the leaders of the community theater in Austin and become friends with Lyndon Johnson's sister, Josepha Johnson. At that time, Kinzer, Josepha Johnson, and others in the theater community were engaging in heterosexual and lesbian threesomes and orgies. After the 1948 election controversy, Clark and Johnson knew not even a hint of scandal could ever attach itself to Johnson's name again. If Lyon Lyndon wanted to fulfill his desire for higher political office, then his reputation had to remain pure. A sex scandal connected to Johnson, or even to one of his family members, could have quickly spelled the end of his political career, especially in the 1950s. Now, Doug Kinzer had opened a small business, and there were indications that Kinzer was president Josepha Johnson, influencer of famous brother, who was in charge of the precursor to the Small Business Administration in Texas to get him some government money. Kinzer may have been blackmailing her, threatening to go public with stories of Josepha's wild, libidinous life. Barr McClellan and other writers believe that Edward Clark directed Mack Wallace to kill Doug Kinzer. After Wallace was convicted, 11 jurors were for the death penalty. One held out for life in prison. Now, the judge handling the case, though, was one of the many judges that Clark owned. The judge intervened, gave Wallace a 5-year sentence. Then he suspended that sentence. Shortly after being convicted of the crime of murder, Mack Wallace walked out of the courthouse a free man. Now, on that note, we're going to end today's show. We've run out of time. We're going to finish talking about Lyon Lyndon in our next show. Until then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great day.